This is day five at the 53rd New Zealand Christadelphian Bible School. Our second period speaker is Brother David Pearce on the land flowing with milk and honey. The subtitle for today is Wine That Makes the Heart Glad. This is the fourth talk in the series. The introductory reading is Isaiah 5 verses 1 to 7. Thank you, Brother David.
My dear brothers and sisters, in the last two talks we looked at how you make bread in Bible times and how you produce olive oil in Bible times. Now today we're going to look at wine, which is the third of the three items set together in that early verse we looked at, where wine, oil and bread are all part of everyday living for an Israelite, and an essential part of his diet is wine, as we shall see. So, picture of the vineyard, vine with grapes on it. I'm sure you've all seen this sort of thing. They grow in New Zealand. You have some good crops of wine here, vineyards here, I know. We even have them in England, actually. The warming climate that we've had in recent years, it's quite possible to grow grapes in England, and we have had won a lot of prizes, actually, with our light wines. Now, so to make wine, you have to start off with grapes. To get grapes, you have to have vines. So vines are grown for grapes. And in the conditions where you were growing up in Israel in Bible times, wine is a safe drink because the water that you might otherwise drink is often contaminated, and wine is much safer to drink. We'll come back to that because the alcohol in the wine tends to sterilise bugs. Now, the law itself refers to vineyards quite early on. Perhaps you'd like to turn, please, with me to Leviticus chapter 19 and see what Moses is promising to the people. Leviticus 19 and verse 10. And this is speaking about the harvest time. We looked at this before, actually, when we looked at the bread. But in verse 10, thou shalt not glean thy vineyard, neither shalt thou gather every grape of thy vineyard. Thou shalt leave them for the poor and stranger. I am the Lord your God. I was generous to you when you were slaves and had nothing. You've got to be kind and generous to the poor who also have nothing. So, yes, don't gather every grape. So that was there, fair enough. Now, in Numbers chapter 13, he tells them they're going to walk into a land where there are already lovely vineyards waiting to be used, and they'll be taking them over. And in this chapter 13, you remember those spies that were sent out in verse 23, come back from the land bearing a branch of a vine with one cluster of grapes, and they bear it between two upon a staff. So huge were these grapes. And the place was called the Brook Eschol because of the cluster of grapes which the children of Israel cut down from thence. And there's a painting of the two men carrying these grapes the size of oranges. That's what the land could yield in those days. It still does have lots of vineyards today, as we shall see. Well, grapes are found in the wild. There are such things as wild grapes. And they were actually mentioned in that reading we had from Isaiah a few minutes ago, where God planted good grapes, but it turned out to be wild grapes. Now, the Hebrew name for a wild grape is rather interesting. Literally, it's stinker. A wild grape is a stinker. And it's very bitter and horrible. You wouldn't want to eat it. But over the centuries, people have cultivated the grapes to produce a much sweeter and more full-bodied fruit than the wild one. But as we saw with olives, and it's the same with apples and many other fruits, cultivated grapes have to be grafted in order to preserve the characteristics that you want, the ones that you've spent centuries developing. You want to pass those on intact to the next generation by grafting. And also putting onto a wild grape base makes it strong. It helps to combat disease. I won't go into the process of the actual putting in the buds and so on, because it's the same as we saw for olives. Now, vines thrive on two things, sunshine and good drainage. You have to have both of those, really, to do any good. And you can't have frost. That's why for many centuries we were not able to grow vines in England, because of frost. But nowadays the frost is so rare, certainly in the south of England, that usually you can get away with planting a vineyard. And it's interesting, when you go to Israel, some of you have been there, of course, on trips, the whole of Israel is covered with ancient terraces, ruined terraces, which were once used for growing both vines and olives. So the hillside, with immense labour, has been changed into steps like that. And that's important because these terraces reduce the risk of erosion when you have heavy rain washing the soil down into the valley, and also allows time for the rainfall to soak in before it moves down to the next rank. So here's a photograph from Israel of some of these very ancient terraces. And you see them all over the place, quite ruined, not in use today, but they obviously were there many, many centuries ago. Now, a traditional vineyard, as we read in that reading from Isaiah, let's go back to Isaiah 5 and we'll pick up these essential items for a vineyard. Isaiah 5, a traditional vineyard had, on the outside of the vineyard, a wall or a hedge to keep out nasty wild animals. And it also had a tower so that you could observe if there were any nasty wild animals or even human thieves coming in to take away your precious grapes. So Isaiah 5, verse 2, the vineyard, he fenced it. So that's the outer wall or hedge. And he gutted out the stones. You don't want stones in the way. Planted it with the choicest vine and built a tower in the midst of it. The tower is a watchtower, so you can see what's happening and you can stop the wild animals in their tracks. Now, if you look at Psalm 80, you'll see the risk of these wild animals coming in. Psalm 80 and verse 8, if I can quickly find that for you. Here we go. Psalm 80, verse 8. Verse 8, Thou God, Thou hast brought a vine out of Egypt. That's Israel, of course. Israel's the vine. Thou hast brought a vine out of Egypt, cast out the heathen, that's the Canaanites, and planted it. And perhaps that's casting out the stones in that passage in Isaiah. Take away the stones. These are the Canaanites, the horrible people who are doing horrible things. So cast out the heathen and planted this vine. Thou preparest room before it, and it took deep root and it filled the land. But, verse 12, Why have you broken down her hedges? So that those who pass by the way do pluck her. That's human thieves coming in, walking in and helping themselves. And verse 13, The boar out of the wood and the wild beast of the field devours it. So that's why you had to have this hedge round and the watchtower to catch these things before they happened. Now, every self-respecting vineyard also had a vat for the juice. And in verse Isaiah 55, if you're still there, Isaiah 5 verse 2, it says he made a wine press therein. Now, wine press isn't really a very accurate word. It's more a vat, a hole in the ground. Unlike olives, which you have to squeeze very hard in a press to get the juice out of, grapes have a very thin skin, and the juice is broken out of the grape by human feet trampling on them. So all you need is a hole in the ground. And that's what it says there in Isaiah 5, a wine press therein. Just a hole in the ground. So here's some pictures. That's a vineyard watchtower, ruined, of course, very ancient, but that's what it looked like. That's where you would send your little boy to stand and watch and shout if anybody came, or to throw stones with his sling at a marauding animal that was trying to make a hole in the wall. And this is an ancient vat. It's just an excavated hole in the rock into which the grapes will be put after plucking them, and then they will be trampled under feet. Okay, so those are the essential items for a decent vineyard. Now, the young vines were planted in rows, and sometimes they were trained onto wooden frames and sometimes draped over walls. There's a reference to Joseph in the lovely blessing in Genesis 49 about Joseph being trained along a wall. It takes at least 3 years to get your first decent crop of grapes, but much less time on olives, of course, which were 6 years yesterday. So here is a modern vineyard with the grapes planted in rows. You can see the wooden supports there, and you see the terracing down the hillside, and the well, it's a very well drained. That's actually from France, of course, which is the capital of winemaking. Well, as the vine branches begin to spring out every spring from the twisted stem, they have to be pruned heavily to allow light and air to get into the centre of the foliage. And for eating grapes, you have to thin out every bunch of grapes with a special pair of scissors nowadays, a knife in those days, in order to get bigger berries. Otherwise, the berries are quite tiny and not particularly attractive. Now, that comes up in John chapter 15. Let's go to John, New Testament, and Jesus' own words at the Last Supper. John chapter 15. And this perhaps explains something you might not have picked up possibly before. John 15, verse 1, Jesus says, I am the true vine. You understand true doesn't mean true as opposed to false. It means the real thing as opposed to the type or shadow. I am the true vine, the real vine. And my Father is the husbandman, the vine dresser, the one who comes along down the rows of vines. And verse 2, here's what God does. Every branch in me that beareth not fruit, he takes away. So an unproductive branch, perhaps diseased, or so old it's not working anymore, is cut out of the vine. And here's a look at the last part of verse 2. Every branch that produces fruit, he purges it. Or the Greek word there is cleanses it. He cleanses it that it may bring forth more fruit. So that's the process of going down the vine row and cutting out a lot of the foliage to allow the light and air to get in, and each individual bunch taking out individual grapes to leave a few that will then get much bigger on the sap that's flowing through from the vine itself. So that's the process of taking away bad branches and purging or cleansing the good branches to make them produce better fruit. Of course, from the point of view of the grape, that's probably a very painful process. Nobody likes having their legs cut off. And sometimes God is doing that to us in our lives. Sometimes he does things to us which are very unpleasant, and we writhe underneath them. But that's what Jesus is trying to teach us. We have to expect that. We have to expect that. We have to abide, verse 4, he says we have to abide in Jesus if we want to bear proper fruit. We can't branch out on our own and have our own individual vine. We have to draw our sap from Jesus himself, and then we will bear fruit. So here's a picture of the bud in the early part of the season. You see the green leaf. They come up every year. They start off from scratch with a new set of leaves. And that's the vine bud. That then turns into a flower. Fairly insignificant, not particularly attractive, but there it is. And then that has to be pruned to produce a bigger crop. Modern pair of secateurs. In the old days, you had a knife with a sharp knife with a hooked blade. Or in the very early days, it would have been a flint knife, probably. And you can see here the effects of pruning, right? See, it's been opened up to the light and the air, and you can see these individual berries here are quite big, and that's a result of taking out a lot of the berries to leave a few big ones. So that's the pruning process in the summer. And that goes on all through the summer. Have any of you got a vine at home? Oh, quite a lot of you have. Yeah, well, you know, if you don't do this, it just goes boom like that, and everything's covered with greenery. We have one on our hedge, our fence at home, and now, if you didn't keep pruning it, the fence would fall down under the weight. It takes a lot of pruning to keep it under control. It's very, very fast growing. Now, harvest time comes in September in Israel. That's when you see a bloom on the berry, the actual glowing sort of musky colour that tells you it's ready for cutting. In the old days, of course, in Bible times, the grape bunches were individually cut off with a sickle. Revelation chapter 14. Let's have a look. The harvest of the grape. Revelation 14. See how these figures of speech are drawn from agriculture, and they found their way into the Bible. So verse 18, an angel comes down from the altar, and he cries to the man with the sharp sickle, thrust in thy sharp sickle and gather the clusters of the vine of the earth, for her grapes are fully ripe. So the angel chops off the grapes, throws them into the great wine press, verse 19, this big vat, and the wine press is trodden. The men come in and start trampling on the grapes outside the city, and blood comes out. This is a symbolic wine press, of course, and this is the judgment of God on rebellious men who have refused to repent. A little bit earlier at the chapter, in verse 15, we had the harvest of the wheat, which is much earlier in the year, in August. That comes first, and then the second harvest, that's done with a sickle too. Verse 16, he thrust in his sickle and the earth was reaped. That's the harvest of the wheat. And then back down here in verse 18, a sickle for cutting the vine. So you end up like this in this picture here with a mass, a solid mass of bunches of grapes. And that goes into the wine vat. And then, as we said several times already, what next happens is that men come along in bare feet and they trample on those berries to release the juices from the vine, from the berries. They can be, you can have red grapes, by the way, and you can have white grapes. You can grow them either way, and you get white wine or red wine, respectively, depending which one you started off with. Now, what's rather fascinating, it comes several times in the Old Testament. The men coordinated their trampling on the vine, the berries, by shouting. Let's have a look. Jeremiah chapter 25. It's quite funny, really. Jeremiah 25 and verse 30. Jeremiah 25 and verse 30. Prophesy against them all these words and say, the Lord shall roar from on high and utter his voice from his holy habitation. He shall mightily roar upon his habitation. Here he comes. He shall give a shout as they that tread the grapes. As they that shed the grapes. And if you lived in Israel in Bible times, in October, September, October, you would hear all over the place the shouts of these men as they're trampling the grapes. And they're happy to do it, of course, because all those long, weary weeks of cultivation and pruning have now culminated in this wonderful crop, and they're shouting with joy as they trample the grapes. Another one in chapter 48, a few pages over, chapter 48, verse 32, same prophet, Jeremiah. 48 verse 32. O vine of Sibmah, place in Israel, I will weep for thee with the weeping of Jazer. Thy plants are gone over the sea, they reach even to the sea of Jazer. The spoiler has fallen upon thy summer fruits and upon thy vintage. The spoiler, the enemy, has come in. And here it is, verse 33. Joy and gladness is taken from the plentiful field. I've caused the wine to fail from the wine presses. None shall tread with shouting. Their shouting shall be no shouting. So it would have been joy and gladness in the beginning of the verse. But now, because the enemy have come in and taken over the fruitful field, the vine presses have nobody treading them anymore. And so it's a rather gloomy picture there for Jeremiah's people. So now we have juice. Juice from the grapes. And this juice is run off into a separate vat where it can settle, because you're going to get bits of leaves and some dirt and stuff, and goodness knows what's off the people's feet. It's got to settle to the bottom so that you can then take off the clear stuff from on top. It then gets transferred, in Israel times, to jars so that it can ferment quickly. In those days, you didn't need to add yeast to the grapes, because the grapes have a natural yeast that grows on the outside of the skin, the bloom, and that's sufficient to start the fermentation, which is a process we'll come to. It's converting the sugars in the juice to alcohol. And that goes on for a week or two. You see it fizzing and bubbling. If you've made wine at home, you'll know all about this. And once the fermentation has ceased, then the jars are sealed to store the wine ready to drink later on, and to stop flies and contamination coming in. The alternative was to use goat skins or sheep skins to act as the container for the wine while it is fermenting. And I'm sure we don't even need to look this one up, do we? Matthew chapter 9, Jesus, don't put new wine into old wine skins. Otherwise it'll burst, because they're not elastic. The new wine skins are elastic. You take a poor old goat, you have him for dinner, you save his skin, cut out very carefully so that you cut round his toes and his feet, and you can take the whole thing off the body of the dead goat or whatever it is, and then you tie those up, and you end up with a hole where his neck is, where you can pour in the juice from the wine, from the grapes, and then you seal that up, and it ferments and bubbles, and it's, you know, sufficient elasticity there to allow it to stretch and give without bursting. So that's an alternative, jars or skins of animals. Okay, so now we've got the wine on its in its storage containers. Let's go back to the vine. We haven't finished yet. We've got the harvest in, but we haven't finished yet because there's a big job to do in the winter months. During the winter months, the long winter months, the vines are pruned right back to the stem. All that fantastic growth that's come out during the summer It's cut right back to the stem. And you also have to get rid of briars and brambles, which have come up during the season. Remember, of course, in Israel it's going to be hot, and things will grow much faster. And any diseased branches, which might contaminate next year's crop, they must be cut off, ruthlessly cut out, as we saw from John at the Last Supper. And then those clippings have to be burned. Why do you burn them? So that no disease can be transferred through to next year's crop through the soil. That's right. Let's have a look. Isaiah 27. Isaiah 27. It actually mentions this process of the burning, pruning and the burning. Isaiah 27, verse 2. In that day, sing ye unto her a vineyard of red wine. Again, it's Israel. A vineyard of red wine. Obviously, they're red grapes, aren't they? I, the Lord, keep it. I water it every moment. Lest any hurt it, I will keep it. He's keeping the vine. That's the keeping out the wild animals and the human thieves. There's briars and thorns there, verse 4, which have to be got rid of and burned. In the end of verse 4, I will burn the briars and thorns together. And then verse 11, here we come to the autumn. It's still the vineyard of verse 2, still in the autumn of the same vineyard, verse 11. When the boughs thereof are withered, they shall be broken off, and the women come and set them on fire. So that's the clippings from the vine being burnt in the fire by the ladies. It seems to be the ladies' job to do the burning of the vine. Actually, it's interesting that, because when Jesus talks about it in John, he has men doing it. So perhaps it's sometimes one and sometimes the other. Anyway, there's a picture of a modern viticulturalist pruning his vines, getting rid of all the growth from this year right down back to the stem. And because it's cold, you can see as well, wrapped up against the weather. And here they are burning the clippings. In this case, a mobile barbecue type thing on wheels. That is used to burn up those clippings, which you mustn't allow to hang around on the ground, otherwise they might infect next year's crop. Now, an important point, and this is one of the passages we have in the Bible, the sole purpose of having a vine is to produce grapes. The vine is not ornamental. It doesn't look good, and the flowers are hopeless. And the wood of the vine is useless. You can't use it for timber. Because it's so twisted as it grows in all sorts of directions, you can't ever get a straight piece of wood out of it. Ezekiel 15, and you'll pick this one up now, perhaps make a little bit more sense of something you've read time after time in Ezekiel. Ezekiel 15, verse 2. Son of man, what is the vine tree more than any tree, or a branch among the trees of the forest? Shall wood be taken thereof to do any work? And the answer is no. You can't do any work with vine wood. Other trees, sycamores, cedars, olive trees, perfect, lovely wood. But not vines. Or will, here, end of verse 3. Will men take a pin of it to hang any vessel thereof? That's an interesting one. In Isaiah 24, when it talks about Shebna being demoted from his task and replaced, the man who replaces him is said to be a pin in the wall. The very latest up-to-date kitchens in Israel in Bible times had a row of pins in the wall made of wood on which to hang your precious cups, pots and pans and frying pans and stuff like that. So when your guests come in, that's my kitchen stuff. Well, he's saying here in verse 3, you can't use vine wood to make a pin on which to hang your precious iron cooking pot. Verse 4, all you can do with vine wood, verse 4, is to cast it into the fire for fuel, and the fire devours it. You see, the whole purpose of having a vine is to produce fruit. And if it doesn't produce fruit, you can't do anything with what's left. The wood isn't any use at all for timber. You can't even make a pin to stick in the wall to hang your pot on. So that's very sad, of course, and that's Israel, God's people, in this passage in Ezekiel, had not produced fruit. God came looking for fruit, and there wasn't any. So the only thing he could do was to burn it with fire. And of course, That's what happened when Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, comes along and he sets Jerusalem on, literally sets Jerusalem on fire. And that's the end of the state, at least for the time being. Now, this point that Ezekiel's making, you can see from this picture, you couldn't ever get a straight piece of wood out of there to do anything with. My daughter came back from on these school trips to France, actually, once, and she brought me back a present. This present was a corkscrew. And the handle of the corkscrew was made of a little piece of the vine like that, with a metal thing going around the corkscrew to go into the cork. And it was about this long. And that's all you could do, to get a little piece of wood like that. And of course, being vine, it fitted with a corkscrew for making opening bottles of wine. So that proves the point, really, that it's not useful for anything like proper household furniture. You can't do anything. Vines are only grown for fruit. That's the point. Only grown for fruit. Now, a word about strong drink, because that's another thing that comes up in the Bible quite a lot. Barley is the material that you use to make beer. In the Bible, when you read strong drink, it means beer. When we talk about strong drink, we think of vodka or whiskey. That's made by distillation, by taking alcohol, a low alcohol fluid, and passing it through a distillery system where you heat it up and allow it to condense and catch a much higher rating alcohol fluid out of the other end. And that process can give you vodka, can be up to 20%, 30% alcohol, whereas wine only gets up to 10, 11, 12%. But that's unknown in Bible times. So when you read about strong drink in the Bible, it's talking about beer. And barley is the source, the main source. You can use wheat, but it's also used for making beer. And that's why it was grown in Israel. So in the King James Version, at least, if you read strong drink, you're talking about beer. Distillation, unknown in Bible times. What's interesting is the Philistines were great beer drinkers, unlike the Canaanites who surrounded them, who drank wine. And when the archaeologists did their excavations in the Philistine cities, those five great cities, they found loads and loads of these beer mugs, because that's what the Philistines, you remember, travelled across the Mediterranean from places like Crete. They moved across in Bible times and landed on the west coast of Israel and settled in where the Gaza Strip is now, of course, the Philistine territory. And they brought with them their own customs, their own dress, their own sociological system, their own gods, even the armour that they wore for war, even the idea of a hero, Goliath, being representative of the nation, straight from Greece, where they came from, you see, from way across the west of the Mediterranean. They imported that into their part of Israel, including drinking beer. Well, the process of making beer is like this. You start off with barley, you spread out the grains on a flat surface, and you make them wet. And soon after that, they will start to sprout. The barley grain will germinate, and up comes a little tail. As soon as you see those, you scrape them all together and you roast them. You roast them in the oven. And then you grind them to a kind of flour, coarse sort of flour. And you mix them with water and you warm it up. Well, that's stage one, and that's called malting. And during that time, enzymes will turn the starch of the barley grain into sugars. Now, in the UK, this business of producing the malt is kept quite separate from the brewing, which is making the actual beer itself. So if you go to a place like Burton-on-Trent, which is famous for beer, the monks discovered that the water underneath Burton is fantastic for making beer, hundreds of years ago. It's still there today, and that's where we get a lot of our British beer from. So you've got, in that city, you've got whole little industries which are involved in malting, producing the malt, and you've got other places where you do the actual brewing. I worked in agricultural college, and we used to take the students there on visits, and of course they just loved it, didn't they? You always got a free mug, pewter mug of beer at the end. It was chained to the wall, so you couldn't take it with you. They were all allowed one big mug of beer. So it was a very popular visit. So that's the first stage. And then the second stage is the fermentation with yeast, which gets the sugar turned into alcohol. A modern beer is flavoured with hops, which we grow in England, down in the south, in places like Kent. I don't know whether they had hops in Bible times. I've never read come across it in anywhere in the Bible, and nor in archaeology either. So maybe they just drank it plain without the hops. But the hops make it bitter. Beer is bitter, and that's because it has these hops in, which give it this special flavour. Now, here's an interesting thing. Here's a tablet from Ur of the Chaldees in the time of Abraham. It's dated 2050 BC, and it's a recipe for making beer. Time of Abraham, Ur of the Chaldees. So Ellen Woolley, a great English archaeologist, excavated the ruins of Ur. And this is what barley looks like, the malted barley, when it started to sprout. You can perhaps, it's not a terribly good photograph, but you can perhaps see the sprouts coming out of the grains there. And here are some of those Philistine beer jars we talked about. I think they call them craters or something like that. Anyway, that's where the beer will be drunk from. So we've done wine, we've done strong drink in the Bible, which is a completely separate thing, and it's just as bad or good, whichever way you like to look at it. In fact, let's have a look at that. Wine, is wine good or is wine bad? Well, there are points in both directions, actually. Let's have a look at some of the good points. Well, as we said already, the wine contains alcohol. The yeast will turn the sugars into alcohol until the alcohol content of the mix reaches somewhere between 10 and 13%, at which point the yeast will die. They just kill themselves off because the alcohol is so strong. They die. And depending which particular strain of yeast you've got in your vineyard, it'll go higher or lower. Okay. Now, beer is much lower. That's around about 5% alcohol. So you have to drink a lot more beer to get drunk than wine. That's pretty obvious, really. Well, the point about alcohol is it will kill germs. And as you've all had injections at the clinic, I'm sure, sometime before they inject you, what does the nurse do? She takes a piece of alcohol and she rubs your skin with alcohol because it kills germs. Then she pushes the needle through your skin. So alcohol kills germs. That's a good thing. And where the water that you're trying to drink could be contaminated with bacteria, the alcohol will make it safer to drink. And the Israelites used to dilute wine with water to drink on a hot day. You obviously couldn't drink pure wine all day, but otherwise you need something like 2 litres of fluid on a hot day in Mediterranean. If you had 2 litres of wine every day, apart from being expensive, you'd also get very drunk. So you mix it with water to dilute it a bit, but it makes the water safe to drink. And there's a famous passage, isn't there, in 1 Timothy, you remember this one, where Paul, in his letter to his young friend Timothy, advises him to stop drinking water only and to take a little wine for his stomach's sake. He'd obviously be having problems with stomach upsets from dirt, bad water. And if he changes over to wine, Paul says, a little wine, he says that you'll feel better. You'll be healthier. And that brings the question of the wine that we use on Sundays, what you might call communion wine. I don't know what you do here in New Zealand, but in England we actually buy communion wine. It's developed for this purpose. And communion wine is normally fortified. That's to say, it's got a higher alcohol content than normal wine. Because they take other wine that's been distilled and add the alcohol from that to the ordinary wine to get it up to something like 14-15% alcohol. And that means that when you're drinking from the cup, as we do in England, it's very unlikely you're going to get infectious diseases because the alcohol will sterilise the rim of the cup quite quickly as you drink it. The soldiers at the crucifixion of Jesus, let's have a look at John chapter 19. It's lovely, well, not lovely, but it's an interesting point here. John 19, verse 28, Jesus on the cross, very thirsty. Jesus, knowing that all things were now accomplished, that the scripture might be fulfilled, he says, I thirst, I thirst. And they hear him crying out, I thirst. And there was set a vessel full of vinegar. It says vinegar in the Authorised Version. If you've got a modern version, it probably says sour wine. Yeah?
Wine vinegar.
Okay, sour wine. Okay. So they filled a sponge with this vinegar, put it on a stick and hold it up to the mouth of Jesus, because of course he's hanging above the ground on the cross. When he received the vinegar, he said, it is finished. And he bows his head and gives up the spirit. Now those soldiers on guard for the crucifixion. I had to be there all day. Normally, I know there was a darkness fell over the land in this particular crucifixion, but normally they'd be there for hours on duty, perhaps even days, because some of these wretched people would hang on the cross for days before they finally expired. And the four men with their centurion had to make sure that the criminal died before they were allowed to leave. So they had to have something to drink. And they couldn't drink, they won't be allowed to drink wine, because otherwise they might get drunk. Imagine soldiers with a pot of wine. So they had sour wine, vinegar wine, which isn't enough alcoholic to make you drunk, but it will quench your thirst, as it does happily in the case of our dear Lord as he's dying. And one last point there, the scientists say, if you drink a moderate amount of wine, and we're talking about 125 millilitres, that's a small glass, not one of these big balloon glasses that you... And people say, oh, I only drink one glass of wine a day, but it's a huge glass like that. No, 125 mil, you will actually live longer than somebody who's a teetotaler, who doesn't drink wine at all. And they say that red wine actually is probably better than white, because it has things called xanthophylls, which are good for you. Now, the bad things about alcohol, there's lots of bad things. One obvious thing about alcohol is if you drink it, it slows down your reaction time. So if you're driving your car and you've been drinking and you come to a bend, it takes a little while to realise you're coming to a bend. Or somebody puts the brakes on in front of you, it takes a little while to realise he's got his brakes on. Or if you're speaking, your speech not well, because you can't control your muscles of your throat like you normally would do. It slows down everything in your body. If you're trying to walk along the road, you know, and your balance canals, with the kids over there, we're talking about the balance canals the other day in the back of your head. And those balance canals will get slowed down if you've been drinking too much. And you'll start to fall, and you will fall and go along like this. Rather normally, you walk like that. That's right. The balance canals tell you soon the moment you're starting to fall. But in this case, they're very slow. Slow to react to getting out of the vertical. And so you fall over. Well, that's one point, of course. Now, the other thing, and this is really important, and this is what we have to tell our youngsters in England, and I'm sure you do here. The bad thing about alcohol is... it switches off your inhibitions. Now, the way I put it over to the youngsters is, here in the front of your head, inside your head here, is a little man. And he says to you, when you start to do something naughty, he says, stop. Now, if you start drinking wine, alcohol, beer, that little man will go to sleep. And he won't be there to say stop. And so you'll go on and do bad things. And some of these things. Dutch courage, you have that expression? Dutch courage? You're going to do something pretty daring. So to fortify, it's like give yourself encouragement to do something naughty, you take a drink of wine or beer or whatever it is. Most crimes are committed under the influence of alcohol. Most crimes. Immoral behaviour. You go to a dance, a party, drinking plenty of alcohol. And before long, that little man stops saying, hey, you shouldn't be touching that woman. And you go into bed with her. And you would never do it normally. Never. But under the influence of alcohol, that little man goes to sleep. And you do stupid things like that, which you can't undo. And sadly, and we find this an awful lot in our Russia visits, domestic violence. The man drinking alcohol, coming home drunk, and beating up his family, his wife and his children. I've had lots of cases like that. So... don't drink. That's the message for our children. 125 mil, okay, stop. One interesting point, and this comes out in a Bible story, when you drink alcohol, another part of your body's amazing systems that gets knocked out is your temperature control. You know, the human body is designed to keep a body temperature, around about 35, 37 centigrade, wherever you are, North Pole, equator. It'll keep you round about that temperature. It does this in the case of the northern pole by putting clothes on or shivering, in the case of the equator by by sweating, perspiration from your skin. And the water evaporating from your skin pulls your temperature down. The process of evaporation cools the skin. Well, if you drink a lot of wine, that control system will go out of kilter. And the blood in your body, instead of being held in for the important organs inside, will start to move through to the skin, to the peripheral blood vessels in your body. And you'll start to feel hot. You aren't really hot, but you feel hot because the blood's now migrated to your skin. And so you take your clothes off. And that's what happened to Grandpa Abraham, Noah, in chapter 9. So look, it's not chapter 9, you know what these words. Very undignified, very unhappy, really. Chapter 9, verse 20. Noah began to be an husbandman, a man of the ground, and he planted a vineyard, and he drank of the wine. And he was drunken, and he was uncovered within his tent. So the skin's overheating to the dilation of those veins on the surface, and he took all his clothes off. So don't do that. Right, we haven't finished with all the bad things. Alcohol is toxic, it's a toxin. And that's why if you drink a lot of alcohol suddenly, not used to it, your stomach will reject it. I'm going for dinner in a minute. if you don't want to turn this one up, don't. But Isaiah 28, this is what happens to people who take too much alcohol. Isaiah 28, verse 7. They have erred through wine and through strong drink are out of the way. Out of the way. They've lost their sense of direction. The priests and the prophet have erred through strong drink, beer. They are swallowed up of wine. Wine. They are out of the way through strong drink. They err in vision. They err in vision. They can't see straight. Seeing double. They stumble in judgment. The balance canal is not working. Fall over. And the tables are full of vomit and filthiness because your stomach's heaving and pushing out that toxic material from your body. So to protect it, of course. Now, in the body, as you probably know, the liver, that marvellous organ, the liver, will deactivate the alcohol that's flowing in your bloodstream, but it takes time. And if you drink wine or alcohol in the evening, there will still be traces of it in your bloodstream in the morning, and you might even be caught by the police. And the last thing about it, the bad thing, is that alcohol is addictive. And let's finish with that gorgeous passage from Proverbs, which warns us not to drink. Next door to Ecclesiastes, same writer. Proverbs 23, yes, here we go. The classic passage about the drunkard. Verse 30, they that tarry long at the wine, that go to seek mixed wine, mixing up different wines, look not thereupon the wine when it is red, when it giveth its colour in the cup, when, NIV, it goes down smoothly. At the last it bites like a serpent and stings like an adder. Your eyes shall behold strange women. Your heart will utter perverse things. You'll start saying things you would never normally say, because your little man will say, stop, stop, but he's not saying it, he's not working. Thou shalt be as he that lieth down in the midst of the sea, heaving up and down. You lose your sense of balance, lying on the top of a mast. They have stricken me, shalt thou say, and I was not sick. They have beaten me, and I felt it not. When shall I awake? I will seek it yet again. I will seek it yet again. It's addictive. And once you start taking alcohol, in the end, you can't stop. Sadly, the high calorific content of alcohol means you're not hungry anymore. So you spend your money, or precious money you would have spent on food, on more alcohol. And that unbalances the diet, because you're not taking in protein, you're not taking in vitamins and minerals that you need for a sensible, healthy diet. And so you end up, in the end, if you go on, with cirrhosis of the liver and eventually death. So, I'm sure I don't need to warn you all about those things, but it's there in the Bible. It's there in the Bible. And it's what we have to teach our youngsters who are not perhaps familiar with this and see what goes on. Just a few minutes on the symbolism of the grape. Let's go to a more cheerful subject. The symbolism of the grape. As we said, the sole purpose of the vine was to produce fruit. And the New Testament talks about the fruit of the Spirit. And in Isaiah 5, that chapter that we had for our initial opening reading, it says in verse 7 that God looked for the fruit. He looked for judgment. That is to say, righteousness, being upright. He looked for judgment, but behold oppression. For righteousness, but behold a cry. The fruit wasn't there in Israel. We saw how Jesus told us in that passage of John that God in heaven will prune us to increase our yield of fruit. And it can be very painful, but that's what we're here for. God's word is the pruning knife. Remember that passage in Hebrews 4? It's sharper than the two-edged sword. It penetrates even to the sinews and the marrow, says the apostle. This is God's word. It prunes us. It says to us, that's wrong. Cut it off. Take it out of your life. And as John 15, Jesus said to the apostles, we can only produce fruit if we're connected to Jesus. We can't go off on our own and start our own Christian community. We have to be part of Jesus. The apostles had to work together as a team, taking their strength and unity from Jesus himself. In terms of the Noah, we discovered how wine and strong drink can dull the conscience. The woman in Revelation chapter 17 fools the nations with her false teaching. Here it is. Babylon was a golden cup in the Lord's hand, making all the earth drunken. The nations drank of her wine and they went mad. That's picked up in Revelation, of course, in the last days, and applied to the woman who rides the beast and brings the kings of the earth in war against the Lord Jesus. Here's a beautiful one, brothers and sisters, absolutely beautiful one. This is Genesis 49. How about this? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, says the aged Jacob, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until tribute comes to him, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. Now, who is going to reign? Here it comes. Binding his foal to the vine, his donkey's colt to the choice vine, he has washed his garments in wine and his vesture in the blood of grapes. See how many references there are to vines and grapes. And that's Jesus. He's coming on the ass's back. Yes, he did that. And he washes his garments in wine. His clothes are stained with blood. His own blood. His own blood. The blood that takes away the sins of the world. And because he did that faithfully under God's command, now the scepter will not depart from Judah. He is the king. He is the one to whom the tribute will come. And to him will be the obedience of the people. Lovely, isn't it? As far back in Genesis as that, we got the symbolism of Jesus. And Jesus at the Last Supper. Unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you. The grape juice, the wine, represents the life-giving blood of Jesus. Whoso drinks my blood has eternal life, and I will raise him up at the last day. That's it. Thank you. Yeah, I guess.